Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup. Normally, it would be Diwa asking me the questions, but as he's not here, I'm going to be asking the questions. And we've got Nathan Smith in here to answer them. And we're going to have a discussion back and forth as well. But how are you, Nathan?
Doing pretty well for a Labor weekend.
Good, yeah. Longer weekend. So shall we just get stuck into it? First thing I've got to discuss here is the disinformation project and the government's Violent Extremism Research Centre have recently shut down. These are two big parts of the Ardern government's sort of censorship apparatus, Orwellian censorship apparatus, that they were using to demonise, stigmatise, shut down, pour shade on views and opinions that they didn't like. I was involved in a sort of a panel discussion recently on RCR with Alia Bland and Catherine Ennis-Carter discussing the shutdown of the disinformation project, which I think is a very good thing. It's good to be rid of them. But this violent extremism centre shutting down has followed closely on the heels of that. So it really seems like the government is sort of taking the axe to these pieces of the censorship architecture that the Ardern government set up. So what are your thoughts on that, Nathan?
Yeah, I don't think you're too far from the truth there. I think every incoming government likes to get rid of legacy projects from the previous. The previous government obviously was around for a number of years. That's at least two terms, and there's quite a lot of little baby projects that governments sort of create. This was true in the John Key government and the Clark government beforehand. So the incoming does like to get rid of those ones that sort of stroke the ego. But these couple of projects were very much children of their time as well. Of course, Ardern was ruling during the Christchurch terror attacks, and there was some worldwide interest in dealing with that, or at least preventing the next ones. So she had to do something, or felt politically that she had to do something. So part of that was setting up a whole panoply of different things to approach and deal with that problem. Disinformation and others and violent extremism stuff all sort of came to a head during COVID as well. Again, she was reigning during that time, so her political move was to try and do something about it. And politicians like to at least show that they're doing something. And, one of the best ways to do this is simply to hand it over to the civil service and say, can you guys work on this? Because the incentive of the civil service is not to solve something, but to just continue to work. So these sorts of problems were so amorphous anyway, violent extremism, disinformation. I mean, exactly who describes and knows what those mean anyway? They were never at any point going to be solved. So it was a perfect sort of, let's just kick the can down the road and look like we're actually doing something. And of course, the incoming government as well is trying to do very similar things. And there's only so much bandwidth in the civil service. So time to move those bodies, or those FTEs, as you would say, if you're living in Wellington, to some other project. But I don't think anybody was ever really serious that these things are going to last for very long. They were very much ego stuff. And I think that's just the nature of the beast down in Wellington.
Yeah, I found the Violent Extremism Research Centre, the sort of idea behind that, to be quite sinister. Now, it was set up in response as a way to address the Christchurch terror attack on the mosques. But it was sort of addressed almost explicitly to like sort of far right or like white violent extremism, and it came as part of a sort of project of Ardern and the Christchurch Call and a lot of the other stuff Ardern was doing of trying to paint white people or conservative white people as the major terror threat, almost at the expense of other groups. And I guess Brenton Tarrant is like your N equals one example of that in New Zealand. So, she's got us on that one. But I really felt like there was an effort to paint white people, paint conservative people, paint people who disagree with the sort of diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda, which I sort of put Ardern into, is promoting, I really felt there was an effort to paint anyone who sort of disagreed with that political project as being necessarily violent and extremist, as if, you know, you agree with us or you're a violent extremist. There's no such thing as peaceful disagreement with what we want to do. Is that how you saw it as well, or do you see it in a different way?
No, I think you're right. This is as old as the hills, this sort of approach. You know, the ruling power decides to go in this direction. Anybody who has a contrary point to that is considered to be a national security threat. And, you know, you can be hyperbolic about it, or you can be sort of cautious and sort of gamey about it. But ultimately, if you're not on board with the direction of whatever the state's chosen to do, you know, you're effectively treated as an enemy. I think it's actually pretty easy to pick, for want of a better word, European, white, conservative, whatever you want to pick, because they often are the producers in society anyway. And they've just got too much to do during the day to worry about politics. You know, they got work to do, basically. We've got some producing to do. It's easy to attack those people because they don't really fight back. Like I say, they've got too much to do during the day. And no one really takes it seriously that conservatives, you know, are violent people. You know, conservatives, by their very nature, don't want anything to change. So being violent creates chaos, and chaos is not in their interests. So it never makes any real sense. So I guess a lot of people on that side of the fence just sort of shrug it off and go, well, they ain't talking about me. And, you know, like I said before, the government can then sort of keep going on something that it knows it can't solve and never would solve. And it seems to be, like they say in economics and in the government, it's a bit of a self-licking ice cream cone. It creates a problem that you can deal with forever that doesn't really have a solution. And nobody on the target list actually ever takes it seriously. So in terms of politics, it's great. In terms of policy, attacking people who are the producers, that's where it can get dangerous, because if you start to extrapolate that out to demonizing that group of people and making it harder for them to be productive, well, you're shooting yourself in the foot from a state's perspective. But things get harder at that point. So there's always a line that you don't want to cross, a threshold you don't want to rise above. And I think they kind of did that pretty well. No one was ever really serious about removing guns in New Zealand after the Christchurch attack. It was something that was, let's tweak a few things around the edges. David Seymour came in and protected us all us gun owners from the crazy overreach of government. And I don't think that was a game they were playing. I think that was just a natural return to equilibrium. And I think kind of that's what we're seeing now.
Mm, yeah. I'm kind of prepared to take the win here. To take the win. But I do have one kind of reservation. My observation is that if you look at the Royal Commission of Inquiry's report into the Christchurch mosque attacks, and then you go through a lot of those recommendations, it does kind of feel to me like they might be rolling a lot of this type of stuff just into like the business as usual workings of the public sector. And so, you know, we're kind of seeing, for example, and this will sort of blend into our next topic quite well, but we're kind of seeing like a lot of this systemic racism sort of stuff that sort of puts white people or conservatives at a like a systematic disadvantage being rolled into. We're seeing it in the police. Our friend's name, Kylie Quince, writing her a report for the police, and now the police are going out to people's houses and talking to them about their memes they've been posting on social media and using that to try and threaten to take people's guns away. So yeah, that's my one worry is, although it seems like this stuff's being rolled back, maybe it's just really being incorporated into business as usual for the public sector. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I could get philosophical and talk about the Hegelian dialect. You know, they create one crazy end of the spectrum, and then you push down to the other end of the spectrum, and then they go, hold on, here's a compromise, and they put it in the middle. But that middle just moved. And that's kind of what the process is. It constantly moves to a certain end of the spectrum, but slowly and surely. And people sort of, it's like boarding the frog, right? You sort of suddenly wake up as a you know, 30-year-old European in New Zealand, and you go, well, where are my benefits? You know, where am I going to be able to get a house? Where am I going to be able to compete with for a job? You know, and suddenly you realize, well, I didn't choose any of this, but you kind of compromised over time. You just let it happen. And that's where you are. And if this is presently the way it is, you know, 10 years from this can't be any better, because, you know, the ratchet only moves in one direction and they know what they're doing. But it's easy just to look at this sort of stuff, to your point, and just go, look, we won. But that's the game. You know, they do set up these violent extremist stuff, sound absolutely nuts, and then they roll it back. And then they say, oh, let's just cool it down a little bit. But they have just moved the status quo, to your point, quite significantly further than it was before, probably to the left, if you want to be a bit political about it. But, you know, this is something we've been dealing with for a long time. No one's come up with a solution for that yet. And the people that do tend to get crushed and pilloried anyway. So really, this is the way of politics. And it's hard to get angry at that, because you want to do it to them too. If you're in the power position as well, this is a weapon you'd want to use.
Oh, well, let's move on to a kind of related subject, and that's the Solicitor General, Una Jagosi, if that's the way you pronounce her name. She issued some prosecutorial guidelines. So these are guidelines, I think, that judges are supposed to look at when deciding on how to sentence people, what kind of sentence to hand down. And basically, if you read through the introduction to those guidelines, it kind of says, you know, if someone's a Maori or they come from another background that face a sort of systemic disadvantages, the language was something like that, then, you know, you have to take that into account in your prosecution decisions, which kind of intimates we want you to think about going easy on them to try and sort of even up the prosecution stats, or the number of Maori in jail versus non-Maori, or the number of Maori getting being found guilty of crimes as opposed to non-Maori. Now, she later has rolled that back, decided to withdraw those guidelines after David Seymour and then Judith Collins had a go publicly at her for putting those guidelines, because it is sort of contradictory and against the spirit of the coalition agreement, which stated that we want to deliver services based on need, not race. Whether justice is a service, I'm unsure, but it's certainly against the spirit of it. So what are we to make of this episode? Why did Una Jagosi issue the guidelines in the first place? Surely she should have known that it's not something the government would be happy with. And then now that she's withdrawn them, do you think she's serious about withdrawing them, or is this just all for show and the guidelines will come back with the text watered down a bit, but with the same basic intent behind it?
It's hard to know. I mean, if she's a functionary and not ideological, then she's just doing what she's told. This is just, you know, something that landed in front of her desk, and she can, you know, push it away from her desk and, oh, she's just a robot. I don't think that's the case. I've seen this before in the States and in the UK, where they sort of, it is a little bit of a trick they play. It's almost like a bat signal that goes up. They create legislation. It sounds kind of nuts. They explain why they're doing it. To your point, they say, look, certain races are being arrested and prosecuted at higher rates than others, and we should be doing something about this. They call it equity. It's not equality. And everybody kind of knows, wink, wink, what the code language is. The code language is very simple. This will probably not get passed. It is on its face blatantly racist, and none of the middle ground, New Zealand or United States, will let it pass. But if you know how to speak the code, you'll see the bat signal, and you as a lawyer on your own, sort of disintermediated, disaggregated around the legal world, will start to follow those guidelines in a sort of de facto sort of way rather than de jure sort of way. And then you start getting the law working on its own independently, chasing equity rather than equality. But it's actually not written in legislation. They didn't get that far, because it would never have been taken that way. But then suddenly everybody who knows kind of does that. And you kind of see this with media as well, is that nothing is ever written into law. You don't ever get a directive from the publisher or the editor or anything for you to go and write that. But at some point, you know, the narrative just shifts on something like climate change or pay equity for women or other things. You know, no one's actually saying you should be following a certain line, a certain synopsis. It's just suddenly what people do. And that's the difference between de facto and de jure, right? De jure is kind of like the last piece of the puzzle, but de facto works for years prior to the point that you actually put it into formalization. And so I think she's just sending out a signal to those who understand the code. This is how we're going to be doing things now.
Yeah. So does it even really matter then that she's withdrawn the guidelines? If, you know, a lot of the, I mean, we're having this trouble with the judiciary anyway. They're all part of the same ideological clique, and they're all kind of on board with doing things that way anyway. So whether there's a formal guideline in place or not, you're kind of saying it doesn't really matter that she's sending out the signal. They're going to understand what the signal means. They're sympathetic ideologically anyway. So it looks like maybe that's what they're going to do anyway, unless the government decides to do something differently to put a stop to it. And they have signaled that they are. You know, Shane Jones, David Seymour, and others have said, you know, we're a bit upset about some of the things coming out of the judiciary. They have to be a wee bit careful, I think, under the rules about criticizing the judiciary. But what do you think the government really can do about this sort of behavior and sort of ideological bent on behalf of the judiciary? Is there much we can sort of do about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of tough because you're dealing with people who are trained in and argue for a living. It's their job to try and find, you know, when you hire a lawyer, you're not necessarily asking them to follow the law. You're actually hiring them to find a way around the law so that you don't sound guilty, so that the things you did suddenly aren't guilty. On the face of the law, you were guilty, but a lawyer's job is to make it sound like you're not. These are the kinds of people you're dealing with. You know, that's this is their bread and butter. They also get paid a lot of money to find solutions for their clients. And I think when it comes to, you know, civil defense or like defense for criminals, it's not necessarily as lucrative as in the corporate world. But you can certainly make a nice bed for yourself by showing that you're taking care of the poor and the underprivileged, and that this is how you work. Look at my numbers. And although the law says this, I've been taking care of those sorts of people. And there's lots of places on the bench for those sorts of fellow travelers, shall we say, who tend to get appointed to the bench because they're good at what they do amongst their friends, not necessarily because they're really smart or that they know the law very well. It's because they follow the rules of what the clique says. And I think that's true in most places. Most areas of this world have, you know, cartels, so to speak. And you know the code. You know it's blood in, blood out, and you know that what you should do. And when the call comes, you know, this is how you do it. It's really hard to legislate against that. Because every time you put a legislation in place, you're creating a piece of fortification that it just requires a little bit of smarts to sort of route around. Kind of, you know, like the Maginot Line in France. Well, the Germany just moved up through the forest, and you know they could have this giant fortification and all these laws and rules, but Germany just was like, well, let's go around, and that's what lawyers do all day.
Yeah. Well, that's not very encouraging, but I guess maybe that's the way it is. So another story that broke recently was around former Reserve Bank analyst Jeff Mortlock, who has been putting submissions in to the government on the way the Reserve Bank is behaving, and in particular on the way their board is constituted and its focus on sort of diversity, equity, and inclusion imperatives. And it was quite explicit in what he said. He said, you know, they don't have the requisite skills and experience to be doing like core Reserve Bank stuff properly because they're too focused on this diversity, equity, and inclusion stuff. And he really called them out, and he said it needs to be refocused. And this is a man who used to work in the Reserve Bank, so he would have firsthand experience. He's got a degree of credibility. He's not just basing it on the stuff on the outside, like we see, you know, the Reserve Bank governor coming out and talking about, you know, various Maori stuff and various diversity imperatives. So, from the outside, you've got an economics background. Do you think there's a problem in the Reserve Bank with this sort of stuff? And again, what do you think the government can or should do in response to sort of refocus the Reserve Bank back on its core job?
Well, to the first question, it might be hard for people who've been sold a different line to sort of wrap their heads around, but New Zealand is, I would say, legitimately too small to have its own Reserve Bank policy. We follow in lockstep with what the Federal Reserve in the United States does. They basically set the tone, and we decide what sort of note we're going to play. But they're essentially writing the song sheet, you know, to run an analogy right to the end. Even the RBA over the Tasman has more firepower in terms of what our RBNZ wants to do than we do. So to say, oh, does this affect our economics policy or our fiscal policy? Sorry, not fiscal policy, our financial policy. It's kind of probably a malformed question, because I think we need to ask, does New Zealand's Reserve Bank actually have any agency at all? And I would say probably not, based on how interconnected the global system is and how dependent that system is on America. Just our size. In terms of how it runs, I think this kind of answers your point from previously as well, sort of what can we do about this? I don't think it's an end point just to realize just how weak the RBNZ is in sort of setting its own boundaries. I think this former Reserve Bank senior staffer, he's basically sending another bat signal up, which we can pick up. And we say, look, if you want some real expertise on boards like this, then you need to start training and protecting and then supporting people who have that so they can rise through the ranks into these locations. Preferably in one shot, in one voting power, they just replace the whole board. But also getting into senior management, getting into the C-suite, getting into even middle management, getting people who understand economics and how it works, rather than focusing on DEI. If you personally can support them in any situation you are, especially in government agencies, then they will feel more encouraged to keep rising. And you need to pick these people out. And I think everybody working in these areas kind of knows someone like that. And if you see them being passed over for some DEI hire, then complain, make yourself heard. Don't just roll your eyes and go back to crunching numbers on a spreadsheet. You know, get up there and say something about it. Threaten to resign. Take your skills elsewhere until you get your people who you can trust, who you know have the skills and the talent and the competency into the positions of decision making. Otherwise, it's not going to change. It's not hard to let a DEI person rise to the top, because that's the way the system wants them to get there. So you have to encourage the system to go somewhere else. And I think personally, at every job level, we can be helping to do this if we see something going wrong.
Yeah, I think that strategy would seem to me to require like a sort of critical mass of people willing to engage in it. And I'm a wee bit skeptical whether that critical mass of people exists.
Well, I always remember during COVID, there was a great phrase that came out that said, the people who are like you are just over the hill, but they're not as far away as you think they are. And you can definitely have conversations with five or six people in your team, two or three, whatever it takes. It doesn't actually take a lot. And the people who think like you, I think people don't quite understand just how radicalized and pissed off a lot of normal people are these days. And if you just have that quiet conversation, I think you'll find a lot of you out there.
Well, maybe that's hopeful. Maybe you're right. I hope you're right. So I think this all comes in the context of, like, we've only just managed to get inflation in New Zealand back down within the 1-3% band, and it took 3 years. So the Ardern government and the Reserve Bank, in conjunction, they spent a whole bunch of money, and the Reserve Bank printed a whole bunch of money, and the combination of those two things caused prices to rise. It jacked up inflation by quite a lot. And so we've had high interest rates for a long time now, as the Reserve Bank's tried and has been fighting against the fiscal policy, fighting against the Labor government, and also to a degree the new National government, who's also running quite a large fiscal deficit. There's quite a large amount of fiscal stimulus still going in. So he's been sort of fighting against the elected representatives in trying to bring inflation back down all this time. But still, he bears a large degree of responsibility, I think, for having the interest rates so high. So I sort of see this as kind of helpful for the government in laying a bit of the groundwork, the PR groundwork, that I think is needed to justify some sort of review or some sort of look at or some sort of reform within the Reserve Bank, in order to really go in and have a look at whether they did everything correctly. Because, I mean, Adrian Orr's job is to keep inflation within the 1-3% band, and he was outside for 3 years. So that's just a failure on the face of it. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on the government maybe looking at, or what it should perhaps be looking at, in terms of reforming, having a go at the Reserve Bank to try and... Do you think they'll hold Adrian Orr accountable? Do you think he'll be reappointed? Do you think his job is secure? Do you think they'll reform the machinery of the Reserve Bank in any way as a result of this extended period outside the 1-3% band?
Yeah, it's hard to advise that the bridging of the separation of church and state, so to speak. You know, the Reserve Bank is independent for a reason. You know, you don't really want political influence on one end and then to change it later on and say, look, now we need to punish you for the stuff that we trusted you to do. It's sort of the reason it's independent is so that it can make its own judgments and act on that with the data it best sees fit. I think, to be honest, the Reserve Bank just needs better tools. There are open source tools created by excellent universities in New Zealand that show GDP data on a live basis. I don't know whether the Reserve Bank deals in those tools, but the decisions it seems to make and also the cadence of those decisions, like every handful of months it decides to alter the OCR, for instance. You know, why are we still using, you know, tools and systems that seem to rely on data that is outmoded? We have live data now. Why do we need certain decision points? Why can't it be a floating system based on live data? There's someone smart enough to figure that out. I think that if the government wants the Reserve Bank to make better decisions in the future, it would do better to not punish the Reserve Bank, but to give it better tools and to encourage it to keep up with technology. And I think that's probably a more positive way of looking at it.
Hmm. All right. We'll seg into our next topic. So tikanga and compulsory tikanga in the nation's legal law courses, and tikanga being granted a status almost equivalent to law, or it's a type of law on its own, which is something our legal profession seems to be pushing quite a lot at both the university level, and I think it is actually sneaking its way into law in several areas. So the Coastal and Marine Areas Bill, I think the decision to sort of expand out the range of the coastline up for grabs for Maori had something to do with tikanga being put into law there. So Gary Judd, who's a KC, has been campaigning and working against this. He's been writing various letters to people when he went and presented to a select committee in Parliament recently, asking the nation's parliamentarians to do something about this, to try and address the fact that our nation's legal profession seemed to be pushing for tikanga to be treated as an equivalent to law. And he thinks that that's not appropriate. He thinks that tikanga isn't law. I think that most New Zealanders would probably agree with that, and that agree that there are, you know, significant problems with treating you know, Maori customary practices as if they were a type of law or could function equivalently to law. So do you think Gary's going to be successful? Are we going to have successful pushback against tikanga, and what could that look like?
Yeah, it's one of those fallacies that a lot of people like to think that the law is somehow sitting above society and rules, but just below God. It seems to be sitting up there in this sort of the rarefied atmosphere. But actually, there is no such thing as sort of the rule of law. There is the rule of judges, you know, and lawyers. Essentially, if they decide to interpret it in a certain way, well, because there's no higher authority above them, that's essentially what the law is, regardless of what it says on the paper. And that's kind of always been the case in every sort of society, is that there's no such thing as rule of law. So if you can get your wedge inside that and start to, again, we talk about, you know, difference between de facto and others, you know, you start to create a system where people are just assuming that there are two streams of law in New Zealand. You know, it gives those who want to create a little bit more power for themselves more options to choose tikanga or, you know, Anglo-Saxon law, common law, based on whatever exception and situation they find themselves in. You know, they choose this path today or this path tomorrow. I think that creates, that's retreating from order, moving into chaos, because I don't think there should be a coherent one line for how everybody in a country is treated. This is definitely opening up for, you know, parallel systems, and I don't think in a very good way. And I think making things like this compulsory is also shooting themselves in the foot, because as we talked about before, it's sort of removing the bat signal. If everyone has to learn this sort of stuff, then you can't really pick from the graduates as who would likely be a solid foot soldier for you. You know, if you previously, and you went to go and learn that, or you learn te reo stuff while you're sort of extracurricular during your legal studies, you are basically signaling yourself as, pick me, I'm going to do what's, I want to be on the side of X, Y, and Z. Now that everybody needs to do it, it's kind of hard to find those willing foot soldiers coming out of law school now. So strategically, I think this is a mistake for them because they're, you know, everybody basically has to do it, which means, as I say, but I mean, from a philosophical perspective, sort of how the government of state should work, I think this is only cancerous. And I think it should be pushed back. How to do that is kind of tough because universities tend to be fairly independent and they can decide whatever they want to do. But are foreign Chinese students going to continue to come to New Zealand if they have to take one of these courses? Or if they chose, if they had the choice between New Zealand and Australia, where there isn't a course like this, are they going to take their money there? I think universities will soon find that price signals actually are important and money talks. And so I think, you know, if they certainly want to keep paying for their faculty and, you know, very wealthy students no longer come here, I think that's going to do more effect than legislating against this.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've made some good points there. I think I agree with it. It's really, I mean, tikanga, it's really a power play on behalf of sort of various Maori interests to introduce their competitor to law. And they hope that by doing that, they can have their way more. It also introduces a sort of a two-tier sort of system, doesn't it? So we hear about two-tier systems in a bunch of different areas. We've had, you know, two-tier care over in the UK where the police seem to be, you know, if you're a white British person, yeah, go around to your house and give you a hard time about the memes you're posting on the internet. But if you're one of the Muslim people or, and you protest and you burn things, maybe you get a wee bit violent. Wow, we're just going to look the other way on that stuff. We're not going to take that too seriously. But the real question for me is, and I think you've addressed that and you've got the same answer that I do, and that's that, is it really practical and functional for a country to have two different standards of law applying to different sorts of people at the same time? And I don't think that can really be functional. If it can be, I'm not sure what examples there are in the past of that working. It, just on the mere fact that it creates a resentment within society, just on that fact alone, it would seem to sort of tear society apart a little bit and do bad things for your precious social cohesion. So yeah, I'm not sure that's, yeah, I'm against it. I think it's a bad idea. I don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to make your society worse off. But one of the things, another thing that happened last week that may help to address things like this is that we heard that Richard Preble, former ACT MP Richard Preble, had been appointed to the Waitangi Tribunal, which is a very interesting development. So, I mean, we've heard from Takuta Ferris, who's been on RCR several times, that he basically, I think, what he wants is for the Waitangi Tribunal to basically be the equivalent of like a constitutional body that, you know, you can appeal to have laws struck down and things like this. And he said he was actually comfortable with people other than Maori or iwi, or people with coming from that perspective being appointed to the tribunal. And so that it seems like it's actually starting to happen now, where we're getting people with different perspectives, former ACT MPs being appointed to the Waitangi Tribunal. So, I mean, I'm sitting here puzzling at home thinking, well, what does this mean? What does this signify that we're getting ACT MPs on the tribunal? And what might it mean in terms of what the national government intends for the future of the tribunal? Because we've heard from MPs like Shane Jones, for example, that he's dead set against the idea of the Waitangi Tribunal being used as this sort of quasi-constitutional body that you can appeal to strike down laws. But if they're going to sort of even up the representation, so it's got a more sort of the representation on the Waitangi Tribunal squares a bit more with the representation in Parliament or across the country, would it necessarily be such a bad thing if it did turn into that quasi-constitutional body?
I think let's be honest, the treaty is one of the worst written constitutional documents, I think, in all of Anglo history. It was sort of drummed up pretty quickly. No one really expected it to be part of the constitutional law. It was really sort of like a negotiation agreement. It's been a long time coming, I think, to sort of formalize what that means for New Zealand. I don't think this will be solved in this particular session. I think national government will sort of go towards the end of however long it lasts here not having solved this, because it's in really nobody's interest to solve it. I mean, the treaty offers a lot of people some very peculiar and unique opportunities to throw their weight around. And I really don't think that it's anybody's interest aside from ACTs to actually deal with this. But ACT has proven in the past that it's not really interested in solving problems. It's interested in creating policy to show its donors that it can actually do something. So I really don't think anybody's heart is in this. And I think Preble's appointment here, and I might be a little contrarian here, kind of displays this. You could say he's a former ACT MP. You could also say he's a former Labour Party functionary as well. But that's not what he's been for a long time. He's basically a celebrity columnist. And I appreciate a lot of what he writes, but that's his role now. He's in the media. I think celebrity is probably the right term for him. And his appointment doesn't necessarily fill me with confidence that the people involved in this development are serious about it. I think he's the kind of person you would appoint if you weren't serious about this and you just wanted to create more energy and fire around this. He does have his finger on the pulse of some very important issues in New Zealand, but Richard Preble has been out of the game for a long time. I'd like to see the rest of the panel, but to me, I kind of just push this aside as just extra proof that this actually wasn't a very serious thing in the first place.
Yeah, one of the things that piqued my interest about Richard Preble is that one of the things that I like about what he's been doing recently with his celebrity columnist career is he's one of the few people who's been calling out the immigration issue in New Zealand. So from an economic perspective, he's been one of the few people who've been pointing out we've got a very high rate of immigration and that is partly responsible for the housing problems that we're having, the housing crisis, for the infrastructure deficit, and for the stretched public services we have. I mean, one of the things that someone who cares about the immigration problem, one of the issues that I have is that in housing, for example, everyone always says, and by everyone, I mean the whole political class and the entirety of the media and everyone in the analytical space, the economists, they all say the issue is supply. The issue is supply with housing. Well, why is the issue supply? Why does demand not count when it comes to the housing market? Like, surely it's supply and demand. It's the law of supply and demand. Why would demand not count in housing when it counts for everything else? And Preble was one of the few people who has laid the blame. I mean, the big problems this election were housing, infrastructure, stretched public services, right? In my opinion, immigration is the primary cause of the problems in all of those areas. And it's something that no one talked about. New Zealand First has traditionally talked about immigration as causing some of those problems. They were very quiet on it in this election, surprisingly so. But how does this play into the Waitangi Tribunal debate? Well, I mean, I'm not so sure, but it's interesting anyway. I was going to move on now to a next subject, which was about immigration. So the latest, Dewa and I always do a great replacement update whenever the immigration figures come out. So the immigration figures came out in recent weeks, and what it shows is that the very high rates of inbound immigration are actually starting to track down now. So we were up at around 250,000 people per year coming in recent months, and it's now tracked down to below 200,000. I think somewhere in the 130,000 range. I could be wrong about that, but it's around there. So that's actually positive that the immigration numbers are tracking down. What we're still dealing with, though, is record numbers of outbound migration, both in terms of total outbound migration and the numbers of New Zealand citizens specifically that are leaving, which is up over 80,000. So we've set records in that area for, I think, the past 3 months. So this seems to be driven, for me, by a couple of reasons. So first of all, the poor economic conditions, right? So poor economic conditions are one of the main things that cause people to leave. Incomes are average incomes. The salaries you can earn are higher in many other countries than New Zealand anyway. And so if things are going poorly here, it increases that already significant incentive people have to leave. But the other issue is the large numbers of people coming in actually creates this effect where it drives up housing prices. It creates competition for jobs, the public services and the infrastructure get stretched. The large numbers of people coming in some ways causes a push factor of pushing other people out. What are your thoughts on the immigration numbers, Nathan? Do you think it's positive that they're coming down?
I think it's reflective of something very similar happened in the United States with Mexico. As Mexico actually grew in GDP and per capita wealth, for a while, I think during the Trump campaign, or at least prior to that during the Obama reign, there was a net immigration out of America and back into Mexico, as people who felt much more affinity to Mexico didn't actually necessarily want to, uproot and go and live in the United States, realized that they could make just as much or more back in Mexico as it grew. Now, historically, we've had a lot of sort of East Asian immigrants in New Zealand, a lot of subcontinent immigrants. India is becoming one of the most wealthy places on the planet at the moment. It's surprising how much wealth is there now just sort of being passed around. You go to a restaurant and you wouldn't see much left of sort of $500 or $600, obviously with drinks. But this is normal over there. And a lot of Indians who live in New Zealand go back and visit family over there are astounded that the salaries that they're earning in New Zealand are on par or actually below sort of their family members back in India. And so I think a lot of people who aren't necessarily, as I say, rooted in New Zealand find it easy now to sort of go back to those locations. And I think that's sort of natural. Same with East Asia. China's obviously growing from strength to strength. The Chinese living here, some of them assimilate, some of them decide to go back. And that's just sort of an ebb and flow as those economies grow, especially post-COVID as well. Most of those countries had massive stimulus, and that's starting to sort of flow through and affect productivity, affect business over there, increase the bottom line and make it more attractive for people to come back. The opposite has sort of happened in New Zealand. A lot of money was printed, but it really struggled to find alpha. It struggled to be deployed anywhere. Most people just put it into houses, and that's fine. You can buy, $1 million house, but now you're, paper rich, but house poor. That house it's not liquid anymore. That money now just goes in there, in the house and stays. People don't put it into productive assets like starting new companies. It's been a while since we've had a serious flow of IPOs in New Zealand. That's not a good sign for New Zealand. A lot of our companies, which is fine, get bought and sold overseas. Usually they outsource the New Zealand labor to somewhere else, so people lose their jobs and that happens. Not always, but that does happen. The system here also rewards immigrants far more than it does native-born population in terms of housing, in terms of jobs and all that sort of stuff. There's lots of pathways to find jobs and better salaries here if you're an immigrant, but not so much for people who are born here. And they can see that it's shinier in Australia. And I know a few people who are going to be disappearing at the end of this year, not necessarily because they can't find work here. It's just because the ambition is quite low. They're surrounded by people that don't really see a future. And so everything is kind of, let's just go along to get along. We'll make it to December and then we'll see what next year is. But that's not the attitude that they think they're going to be approaching in Australia. It's a different go get them attitude over there that you just don't see here. And I don't think that's necessarily a problem of Kiwis. It's the incentive culture here doesn't encourage people to sort of become ambitious. And I think I don't think it's necessarily a fiscal thing and how people spend their money. I think it's an attitudinal thing, and I think the system has a lot of blame for that.
So one of the ways that this issue is being sort of it's weaseled its way into the political debate is the conflict between the ACT Party and Brian Tamaki. So Brian Tamaki is running these. Is it a campaign? It's not really a campaign. He's saying things on Twitter. He's making a bit of noise about a lot of things. But one of the things in addition, is immigration. And he's got this tagline that's something like "Make New Zealand Kiwi Again," which is a sort of play on Trump's "Make America Great Again." And I think this taps into his, so he's very pro-Israel and kind of anti-Muslim people, kind of. I hope that's fair to Brian. And so he's critical of, you know, some of the immigrant groups coming here for threatening the national identity, the culture, a little bit. So he wants to make New Zealand Kiwi again. And he sees, the same way I do, you know, the drastic demographic changes that are being wrought by the mass immigration we're seeing. Where, I mean, the numbers I calculated, New Zealand Europeans were down to like 58% of the population at the last census. So that's obviously going to have a whole bunch of effects on the culture. And he's been talking about it. And the ACT Party have come in and criticised them. They've called it, they've called him racist for talking about that. But I just wonder, is that right? So in other contexts, and I think of Tibet, is what comes to mind. So the Chinese Communist Party has a policy with regards to Tibet of basically race replacement in Tibet. They're bringing in Han Chinese into Tibet to sort of homogenize and get rid of the different Tibetan population. And in the past, you know, parties like the Green Party, the Labour Party, all the normal left-wing protest people have protested against this. And I think rightly so. This is a great harm that's being done to the Tibetan people, trying to erase their culture. But somehow, when it's happening to New Zealanders, when it's happening to us, things seem to go around the other way for a lot of people. They think it's wrong for us to complain about it. Why would we complain about that? I mean, we must be racist for complaining about it. So it's the Chinese who are being racist when they're doing it to Tibet. But when it's happening to us, we're the ones who are racist for complaining about it. So who are the real racists here? Nathan, do you have any views on that?
Yeah, of course. I think it's a bit of a truism, I think, that everybody's a blood and soil nationalist for the people group that they like the best. You know, you can poo-poo blood and soil nationalism as being Nazism, but look at exactly the same people who have been decrying that are now pushing hard in the media for Palestine to have its own state. Or as you say, Tibet, there's screeds of examples of this. But if you don't like the particular ethnic group, then suddenly it's a horrible, disgusting thing that they're trying to do. So two other points to make on that, I suppose. Brian Tamaki, he's revealing himself more and more, I'd say month by month now, the pace is moving up, as to be quite an astute political animal. You might not like the guy. You know, might find him quite distasteful, especially his religion, depending on how you fall on that. But he does know how to tap into things that that people are genuinely worried about under the surface. These things aren't discussed on the Herald, but they are discussed over the water cooler. They are discussed at pubs. They are discussed in churches. They are discussed in cafes. And he notices this, and he has, I think, registered that there's quite a well of energy that he can tap into. So I'm not sure what he's planning on for the future. But if he keeps going like this, I think he might have a political career in mind. The other point I wanted to make was very similar to sort of the thread that we've been moving through already. The ACT Party is, I think, just misreading the room. It is one of those parties and one of those groups of people who I know a few of that seem to see humans as being interchangeable, fungible units, that it really doesn't matter where you're born, you deserve an opportunity in the greatest of places. And we always call that the West. That if the native-born population here isn't willing to pick tomatoes or onions down in Southland, then it should just grab some other people who are, because there's no difference between the two. And the ACT Party does this all the time. And so I think their understanding of the world begins from principles that I think are fundamentally wrong. So it's just natural that they would split with someone like Brian Tamaki on this issue, because they simply do not see eye to eye. Who is right, who is wrong? Well, that depends on your priors as well, on your fundamental principles. But ACT does this all the time. They sort of start from the position that all humans are equal and fungible units and can be replaced anywhere and moved around from different parts of the world. And there will be no consequences, because why would there be? And that's how they think. And I think that we're just seeing more of that now.
We've had ex-Simon Court on RCR several times. Good guy. He's got great opinions on infrastructure, energy, RMA, doing good stuff in that area. But he's very keen on Israel being able to protect its ethnic integrity and its territorial integrity, and not being taken over by the Palestinian people who have been displaced and moved out of there over the past century or so. So I just wonder whether he would apply the same standards to New Zealand and New Zealanders that he would to the Israeli Jews. Seems like he's applying a very odd double standard there. But anyway, let's move on to the US election. So first thing, Trump, he worked a shift at McDonald's. We got some great pictures out of that. He seems like, to me anyway, and a lot of people will disagree with this, and they obviously do, but to me, he just seems like a really likable kind of guy. That was a really likable thing to do. Great pictures. A lot of positivity came out of it. People were complaining, making this very strange argument that it was staged. The Democrats are saying it was staged. Well, of course it was staged. I mean, it's a political campaign event. Why are they saying that? They've just got nothing to do to come back and rebut a very effective political campaign event, is my opinion. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think the media despise how good Trump is at goading them into having to talk about him. Yeah, this is exactly the trap that he goaded them into in 2016, if you remember. They couldn't not report on the things Trump was saying. He was perfectly newsworthy. He made inflammatory statements. MAGA was completely new back then, make America great again. Every news cycle, there'd be something new about Trump, and they hated it. They hated spending precious news ink on that. And this is exactly the same thing. But this time, I think people kind of, they expected Trump to sort of do this sort of thing. And yet when he does it, they're surprised. But I personally, I've never seen, and I know I've spoken to you about this personally, I've never seen someone more comfortable in their skin about who they are than Trump. I wish I had that much confidence, that someone who, it didn't matter what they were doing, it was righteous. He's doing this because he wants to do it and because he knows it's important in everything he does. Now, he may have some Machiavellian multiple layer, twisting plan behind this, but he doesn't display that. And I think that's what matters most on a political campaign, is that people need to see that you're feeling righteous about the things that you believe in. And at some point, you have to understand that most of America who doesn't live in gated communities eats at McDonald's. They probably get their first job at McDonald's. McDonald's is very proud of the fact that it teaches you good business skills about how to run a company, how to balance a checkbook, how to be careful with food supplies. Like, it's a legitimate American institution. It's one of the most American companies you can actually have. We measure GDP by the Big Mac Index, for crying out loud. And he goes in there and he treats it like it's a normal thing. Like, it's not special. He's just serving people. And I think analogously, by serving people at McDonald's, he's proven that he can serve people in the White House. And I think that was hugely positive to his campaign. If you weren't going to vote for him by this time, that's not going to sway your vote, but it might get people off the couch. And I think I think it was perfect. Perfect.
Yeah. What I heard people say, I can't remember where I heard this, maybe some random on Twitter or something like that. I heard people say what it shows is that what Trump is communicating to ordinary people by doing this and other things like this is that he respects their taste. And in a sort of an era, an age, a time where ordinary people are feeling a little bit like the elites are sneering at them and holding them in contempt, I think that sort of move does a lot to connect him with the voter base and endear him to the voter base. And I think that's really valuable. He doesn't have to talk about policy, doesn't have to do anything. If people feel like he respects them, he respects their taste, he's not looking down on them, he's not sneering at them like those other guys are, I think that is that's just about the best PR you could get. So let's move from Trump now to Kamala. So while Trump's having these positive PR performances, Kamala seems to be having a little bit of trouble, and it's basically what people expected. She did surprisingly well in her debate with Trump, I thought at least. But in her subsequent media appearances, she's continually found wanting. So in a recent CNN interview, for example, she gave a very poor answer about what being responsible for the migrant crisis. She's constantly pretending as if she's not in office. She has no power over the things that are happening, that it's all someone's fault. And she's campaigning for change, but the change would obviously be a change away from her, and they never seem to make that connection. Interestingly, her running mate, Tim Walz, also makes similar arguments. And a lot of her other, there was a town hall with Anderson Cooper recently. And she proves unable to, I don't know if she's unable to grasp it, but if she is able to grasp it, she's unable to articulate that she has a command of the issues in these areas. So any thoughts on Kamala's PR performances?
I think it's an easy angle of attack to say that she's the ultimate DEI hire. I think that's partially true, has a grain of truth in it. But the thing you kind of have to understand about presidential races in the United States is that the presidential candidate himself or herself, depending on which part of the century you're in, is usually picked for their charisma, their command of the policies, and their ability to connect with the voter base. The vice president, whether it's in candidacy role or actually in office, is usually picked to be someone who has lower charisma than the president, who doesn't have as great a command, who is comfortable being in the background, that is just generally an inferior person as compared to the president, because you don't want someone in the 2IC role who will outshine the president. And that's basically, that's not a mistake. That is how the system has always been set up. So let's just paint what we actually have today. When Barack Obama was in charge for 8 years, from 2008 to 2016, essentially, what we had was a charismatic person and his 2IC, Joe Biden. And we didn't hear much of Joe Biden. He was basically a PR officer. He got to go to events and cut ribbons and, you know, kiss babies and that sort of thing. Okay. Then he was appointed president. Appointed, not voted, because I think we're very comfortable now saying, you know, there was some irregularity, shall we say, in 2020. The issue that you have there is you've got someone who is inferior in almost every capacity now running the office. Who does he pick for his VP? Naturally, someone who's inferior to him. So we're now dealing with three levels of inferiority running for presidential office today. That's Kamala Harris. That's how deep the problem goes. She's not supposed to be charismatic. She's not supposed to have a command. She was picked precisely because she didn't have those things. But that's all the Democrats have. And I think the other point, which is why it's looking so easy that Trump is just demolishing her on every single metric, from when he's debating her to just being out in public in McDonald's. He looks like the better guy because he is. He's been chosen by the people as being the best guy for the Republicans. Kamala is third tier, fourth tier down by the system's own creation. And I think if she had gone through the Democratic primary cage fight that a lot of presidential candidates have to go through in normal years, she would have had to practice in public a lot more. The fact that she was basically the result of a palace coup in the White House a handful of months ago meant that she just found herself in the position of presidential candidate, not having to fight out amongst other Democratic candidates for primacy. And I think so she doesn't have any training and has not got tough leather because she hasn't had to be in a fight and doesn't know the command of English and is also a third tier rate politician at that. So she's struggling naturally. This is just who she is. There's no upside to her at all because she just doesn't have any of the environment.
Yeah. Despite the fact that she's struggling, the polls, although I think Trump is sort of starting to move ahead a little bit in some of the swing states, but the polls are still relatively close. Do you have any predictions for what you think is going to happen in the election? I'm a Trump guy. I hope he wins. And I think he probably will. But I think it's going to be close. And I would be surprised if there weren't some sort of election shenanigans that went on. Is that basically your view as well?
I would agree. I think, you know, if you don't make predictions, you don't have skin in the game, so no one should listen to your analysis. So let's go ahead and make some. I would agree. I think it's going to be close, but I think I'm probably 60-40 on Trump losing at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think, put it this way, most of the votes Kamala Harris gets will probably not be positive voting for her. They will simply be voting for a non-Trump candidate. They will be voting so that they don't have to vote him. They would be anti-Trump rather than pro-Kamala, if you understand. And I think that's kind of what we saw in Joe Biden's election as well. It was not necessarily voting for him as the most competent commander-in-chief. It was voting so that Donald Trump would get out. I actually think you saw the same thing in Obama's first term as well. It wasn't necessarily voting for him. It was voting for something that he represented, which was change. I mean, people saw him as being charismatic, fine. But he ended up being, and actually was hinting that he would be, precisely the status quo that the George W. Bush legacy carried on too. He didn't stop the war in Iraq, didn't stop the war in Afghanistan, continued to do stuff that Bush already had in train to clean up the GFC. And he really didn't change much. Aside from sort of social leanings and stuff, that's kind of what it was. So I think the vote was actually negative rather than positive. But I think that's significant. I wouldn't discount a negative voting strategy. But I don't really think anybody is seriously voting because Kamala Harris is better. They just don't want Trump in.
Hmm. You kind of ruined my segue a little bit because I was expecting you to predict that Trump would win. I mean, I was going to segue on. So now that we think Trump is going to win, let's talk about like what his term would mean. But let's just do that anyway and pretend that wasn't your last answer. So I think Trump has... there's a lot of good things in there if you're someone who is like has a more nationalist perspective, I guess, for want of a better term, which is what I have. So he's promising to the largest domestic deportation in US history. And so if you're have a problem with mass immigration, you want to try and reverse some of the mass immigration that's gone on, that's something that's appealing. On the economic front, he's also proposing policies to rein in some of the excesses of, globalism, free trade policies that have perhaps gone too far, that have enriched an investor elite at the expense of the domestic worker. They've offshored a lot of jobs to geopolitical foes, forcing them to compete with, the low wages in other countries that have resulted in the deindustrialization of the American heartland, all these things. So he's promising to implement policies to try and redress those sorts of things. So those are the positives. But what about some of the negatives of Trump? What about some of the negatives of Trump for people with a more of a right-wing perspective? So he has made some comments, perhaps spurred by Elon Musk, that he wants to greatly expand legal immigration, and in particular legal immigration of highly skilled people. So what are people who are concerned about immigration and wanting to vote for Trump on that basis? What are they to make of those types of pronouncements? Should they be disappointed? Is it okay because it's more skilled immigration? What do you think?
Not to start off my answer with an but I would say Trump's oscillated on that over the past couple of months. I think he did say he did change his opinion. He used to be crazy on just deporting everybody, and then he went to the other side and said, "Oh, let's just let in some H-1B visas, which is like a working visa." And then he said, "Well, why don't we just create some sort of a pathway to citizenship for any student that comes over here?" I think he's just been throwing stuff to see what sticks. Most of it has come back, I think, quite embarrassingly for him, as being like, "Well, this isn't the Trump that we remember, certainly not the Trump I'm going to vote for." So people started to get turned off. I think he's still sort of playing with that. He's got, you know, a handful of days left to really focus on a message before it gets out there. But I think it's one of the things that you kind of got to remember about people like Trump and Musk, to your point, is that these are disappointed leftists. They're not on the right. Like, Trump grew up on the left. He was a Democrat voter all his life until, you know, basically yesterday. Elon Musk has said he used to support and contribute monetarily to the Democrats. Most of the people who are on that side of the fence could probably tell you the same story. They're not really traditional rightists. They don't have those philosophical principles. They're just simply disappointed leftists. And those sorts of people get nervous talking about rightist policies like remigration or mass deportation or blocking legal and illegal immigration to sort of bring it down to manageable levels. They get allergic talking about that sort of thing. So, which is why it was so surprising back in 2016 for someone like Trump to actually stand up on that platform and use that as his main campaign rally. It's not surprising that he's mellowed over time. He's now, what, 10 years older? And that's sort of, you know, people don't necessarily have new ideas the older they get. So he must be reverting back to things that he sort of appreciated when he was in his 20s and 30s. And of course, these people are business people as well. And to them, American isn't necessarily an ethnicity. It is an idea. If you subscribe to it, you can come here. These are the people we're dealing with. Musk is the same. Remember, he is South African, or was born there at least. And he's moved to America because he was chasing an ambition and an idea. Trump is kind of the same thing. He's not really a businessman. He's a marketing guru. He's a person that understands that side of business, but he's never balanced a checkbook in his life. And I think so these sorts of people I don't necessarily think are good waypoints for figuring out how the public is thinking. They're very self-oriented, self-driven, and they have their own bed to feather before they decide to help everyone else. And Musk has his own ulterior motives. The guy wants to get to Mars and create massive businesses. And part of the way you do that is by tapping into the best brains in the world. And if those brains presently happen to be in China, India, Hungary, France, it doesn't matter. He's going to incentivize them to come over and work for him. Because to him, American means something that anybody can subscribe to. That's a long way of saying Trump is not actually a right-wing candidate in America. In fact, I actually don't think America has any right-wing candidates at all. A lot of them are just, as I say, disappointed leftists. And this is the ratchet moving in one direction. It never goes backwards and never goes in the other way. But the one thing I can say positive about Trump is that at least he doesn't hate people like you and me. You know, the rest of the other side, so to speak, or the other parts of the spectrum seem to find any opportunity they can to disparage Europeans and white nationalists or others who are of the bent of more right-wing policies. He doesn't. And a lot of the people around him, like Musk, at minimum don't hate us. And I think that's a positive vote in his direction.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he's promoting at the sort of behest of Musk, this sort of meritocratic, multicultural space capitalism where we're going to, we're going to go to the moon, we're going to import the world, and we're going to use the best and brightest from all around the world to go to the moon. And I guess that the political advantage of that sales pitch is it avoids the really hard fight of rejecting immigration and rejecting multiculturalism, which has sort of been, over the last half century or more, it's sort of been woven into the story about what America is. It's sort of been grafted in. And I think it's very hard for a lot of people to go all the way back and sort of pull that newly grafted in vision out of their understanding of what America is and what it ought to be. And so you kind of avoid that fight with this vision of meritocratic, multicultural space capitalism. It's still got all the appeal of, human achievement, human excellence, human endeavor, all the things that John F. Kennedy talked about in its famous address. You know, we go to the moon not because it's easy, but because it's hard. You've still got all that great stuff, but you don't have to buy into the really tough fight. What I would say to people like Elon Musk and also Donald Trump and their advisors who are promoting this particular vision is all you have to do is read the academic literature. The evidence, the social science is actually on the side of people like me who reject mass immigration and multiculturalism. And we know from the evidence that diversity in and of itself makes society worse on all the normal indicators of socioeconomic well-being. It reduces social trust. It causes people not to go out and do things together in the community. They sort of hunker down. It creates atomized communities. And all your normal statistics of socioeconomic well-being, crime, poverty, drug abuse, they all get worse in these more diverse communities. So I would just ask people who are buying into meritocratic, multicultural, space capitalism vision, just to read the literature on that stuff. And if you do, you'll find out that it's actually people like me who are right about this stuff. But let's talk about some other of the things that perhaps people have reservations about Trump. And another one of those things would be people are concerned about his associations with Elon Musk, people like Peter Thiel, and these people that seem to be tied into the CIA and the so-called deep state. Trump's supposed to be against the deep state. These people seem to be tied into the deep state. They seem to be involved or tied up in efforts to surveil people, to create this global digital system. It's, sort of a global digital system of control. What are we to make about Trump's associations with the likes of Musk and Thiel and their associations into the deep state? How are we to excuse that?
I don't know if it deserves an excuse. What it does, I think, deserve is an understanding of sort of how the American political game behind the scene usually goes on. There is always an elite who is out of power that is waiting in the wings for their opportunity to strike. No culture is homogenous. There's always a left to a right, an up to a down. The cartel or the group that Thiel and Musk and others, especially in the tech industry, especially in Silicon Valley, there, a lot of them are coming out of that, have grown disillusioned over the past 10 or 15 years on the direction that the current ruling elite have been going. And it's hard to talk about ruling elite in America because there's so many euphemisms for it. But there is essentially a group of people, the head of which at the moment publicly is Kamala Harris. And there's and her coterie and the people around her, if you were to sort of build a network, you could see who they were. But they're not the only people. And they're, when you're at the top, as Elon Musk says himself, no one buys a house at the top of the mountain. You reach the top of the mountain, and as soon as you reach the top, you're probably going to fall down, because there'll be someone else climbing up behind you. And that's really what sort of the Thiels and the Musks are, is they're an elite waiting in the wings for their turn. They have just as much power, just as much capital, just as much ambition as the present ruling elite, but they're not as sclerotic. They're not as Brezhnevian, so to speak. They're not as sort of inured to competition. They haven't been in power for a while. They've been struggling. So they have the edge. They have a sharp sword and they're willing to use it. And I think Trump is their weapon to do it, so that they can get into positions where they can start tweaking the system that to be more in line with what they wish and their people need. Does that have anything to do with the 300 million middle Americans? No, unfortunately. You're not voting for this time. You're voting for whether it's blue or red, but you're not voting for whether a new ruling cast comes in, by the way, which has nothing to do with the people that were working in McDonald's. They are irrelevant to this conversation, unfortunately. But they're the ones with the billions of dollars. They're the ones with the giant companies and the connections. And they have chosen Trump to be their vehicle to get into positions where people like Musk or RFK can head an agency and bring in all of their people and start to change things. If Musk does become the David Seymour of America and starts to cut back civil service, slice and dice the bureaucracy, he's not going to do that in places that benefit Tesla or SpaceX or other places. He is going to do that in places that threaten him at the moment. So the DOJ, for instance, Department of Justice, there'd be a lot of targets that he has, but the system essentially will stay set. And Trump will just have a group of people around him who have other agendas that he may not even know about. And at the moment, like I say, he's the vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. And just sort of finally now, we've been talking for quite a while now, so this will sort of start to wrap it up. But another sort of just building on what you said there, another thing that people are concerned about is Trump's ties to Israel and Israeli donors and a lot of the stuff that's happening at Israel. People are very concerned about the potential for World War III to erupt. People are very concerned. I mean, one of the great benefits or things that people liked about Trump first time around is that there was this idea of having no new wars. And there basically wasn't any new wars in his first term. He kept that promise. And that's quite remarkable given America's past track record of fighting wars in all these different places. But people are worried now, and Trump has basically started to express some support sort of tangentially now for the idea of bombing Iran. And people think that that's tied together. Trump has within his own family now, Jared Kushner and his grandchildren, they have they're Jewish, that they have sort of relations and connections back to Israel. People are concerned that Trump is getting roped in. He's going to get roped into these Middle Eastern wars as a result of his connections. Is this another downside? Is this enough to turn people off Trump? What are we to make of this? Is this really America first, to put it in other terms?
No, it's not. America has never, however, just been the continental United States. There has been, and I think Trump is definitely a believer in this, that America is a world project. America is not necessarily just this thing that happens between the two seaboards, that actually does affect the planet. Whether that's malignant or benign is definitely up to people that live in the situations that America tends to put its troops in. They would have a very different opinion about that. But to be honest, to start off with the big things, I would actually be disappointed in Israel if it wasn't trying to spend money to influence American Congress. That's just what other states do. China probably does the same thing. Iran probably does the same thing. They may not be as sophisticated as Israel, but if you are a tiny nation surrounded by people who don't like you and you can bend the will of the biggest lion in the room and you don't try, what are you doing? Like that's low-hanging fruit. So I don't necessarily castigate Israel for trying and succeeding quite well to sort of bend the United States to do what it wants, especially with all the money that it's been getting to deal with its conflict in Gaza and in Lebanon recently. Same for the Ukraine. Zelensky has an incredible marketing power, his persuasion power. Clearly, he's got some support in the State Department and the Pentagon as well. But he should be spending all of his political capital trying to get the United States to help out. That's what a competent nation state would do. The real problem is, why does America let that happen? Why is there congressmen and senators who allow that to happen? And that's a big rabbit hole. But it's essentially, if the American populace is fighting between each other and it's easy for a foreign party to step in and stir that pot, that's not really on that foreign party. You have to ask the question, why are the Americans fighting? Like, why do they hate each other so much? It's because it's really low-hanging fruit for Russia or Israel or trying to do something with that. This is just how international politics works. So there has to be some soul-searching, I think, from the American populace and public as to why are you voting for people or allowing people to stay in the Senate and the Congress if they're so susceptible to these influence operations that are coming from other countries, because they're not going to stop. Neither should they. America tries to influence countries around the world as well. The American populace probably doesn't want that to stop. But you need to shore up your own people that you're voting in, because those are essentially the very thin neck that those countries like Russia and Israel need to squeeze. And there's only 500 of them. And there has been some research in the past asking why there isn't more money in politics, you know, especially in American politics, given the consequences of, you know, changing out the government for your side. There's actually a very low amount of money being used to influence these people. So not only are they susceptible, they're cheap. And that's, I think, again, more soul searching that the American populace needs to have on the leaders it chooses. And they should start with Trump.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I basically agree. I think these are serious downsides, serious negative things, definitely questions that need to be interrogated about Trump. But I still think there's enough there for people to, you know, take heart. I mean, if he's going to, he may not do all the things that he's said, but he may do some of them. He may start deporting some of the Haitian migrants. He may take actions which sort of combat the deindustrialization of the heartland. So there's enough there to give people hope, even if he does some of these other things, even if he, you know, he's caving into Israeli influence. I mean, I'm an international relations student. I studied international relations at university. John Mearsheimer was probably the biggest, most predominant thinker in the field. And he wrote a book on the Israeli influence in Washington. So when you talk about this stuff, a lot of people think it's sort of conspiratorial, but it's not. I mean, one of the most reputed, if not the most reputed scholar in international relations is writing academic papers and books on Israeli influence in Washington and how it's, you know, Israel's interests and America's interests don't always align. So I think these are issues to take seriously. But having said that, I mean, there's also an alignment. there can be alignment at times between Israeli interests and American interests, and it's not always necessarily a bad thing to try and, you know, create some sort of agreement or commonality or, you know, common set of principles between two different nations and two different powers. So I think it's a complex situation, and you've got to think it through very carefully. But anyway, I think we'll leave that there. Thank you for joining me, Nathan. Thanks for listening, everyone. That's been the weekly roundup for this week with William McGimsey and Nathan Smith.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.